Welcome to Sidebar, presented by Defense Diaries. I'm your host, Bob Mata. Today is September 28th, and this is Episode 3.
Lobotomy, myself, and I.
In the first couple of episodes of Sidebar, we covered the incredible breaking news regarding Adnan Syed and his conviction being vacated. Now, after those episodes were published, we heard from some of our listeners, and they wanted to let me know that my admiration for Marilyn Mosby might be misplaced due to the fact that Ms. Mosby is currently under federal indictment for fraud, relating not to anything that she did while she has been the city attorney for Baltimore, but instead for various counts of fraud relating to relief funds that were doled out to Americans during the pandemic. Now, if you listen to our show at all, you know that she is innocent until proven guilty. That's non-negotiable, as the Constitution is pretty clear about that. Now, if she goes to trial and is found guilty, I have to be honest, with respect to what she did in her professional life as the city attorney, my opinion of what she did in office along with Becky Feldman is not tainted in the least. I value liberty, freedom, and justice over money. I just do, and I always will. So whatever her motivation was in leading her to have her administration's mantra be justice over convictions, whether it was to gain notoriety, fame, curry favor, again, in all honesty, I could care less. Because all I care about is the end result, which is that her administration practices what it preaches in terms of righting wrongful convictions. Now, you may agree or disagree with that proposition, and that is your absolute right to do so. And I respect your opinion. But seeing that she is an elected official and has been voted out of office, and very well may be convicted of what she has been charged with, at which point she will pay for her crimes in some form or fashion. None of that is of any consequence to how I feel about what her administration has done. But enough of that until we find out what happens next. Now, this episode I'm pretty excited about because during the course of my life, I've probably watched every movie ever made. Well, that's a gross exaggeration, but I have watched a ton of movies. I consider myself to be somewhat of a movie buff. So, we are going to be digging into the new Dahmer scripted series that just dropped on Netflix. Now, if you haven't watched some or all of the series, consider this to be an official spoiler alert because we will be discussing the entire 10-part series. So if you fall into either one of those categories, you may want to save this episode until after you've tuned into the show. Now, I started binging the series as soon as it dropped. I think as of the recording of this episode, Darren was just starting to dig in, and I didn't have the patience to wait for him to watch it. I was really interested in watching primarily because I had been reading previews that co-creators Ryan Murphy and Ian Brennan would be focusing on the victim's stories as much, if not more, than Dahmer himself, which struck a very familiar chord to what Darren and I conceived for the Gacy season of our pod. And now, having completed the full series, these are my thoughts. First and foremost, let's talk about the elephant in the room. If you aren't aware as listeners, there is a pretty significant movement in the podcast and true crime industry altogether that victims and their surviving families need to be treated more ethically by the entertainment industry. There is a general consensus that the entertainment industry values money over ethics, and frankly, that fact cannot be disputed. As more and more scripted movies and series are being produced, which depict the worst day of victims' lives and the perpetrators who made it so, and those in the industry are being taken to task for not reaching out to the victims' families or taking into account the horrors that they are subjected to, having to repeatedly be exposed to and relive those nightmares. While Dahmer was being marketed as being far more victim-centric than anything else that has been produced about that creep, the victims' families began sounding off after it was released via social media about the fact that no one from the network or the production company had reached out to the families in any capacity. And the families have wondered aloud just how many times do these stories have to be told? When the end result is always the same, that it's just a money grab for entertainment purposes and serves to only re-traumatize the surviving victims and their families. Now, prior to the series dropping, Evan Peters, the star of the series, in a promotional video, tried to address this issue, stating that, quote, "We had one rule going into this from Ryan, that it would never be told from Dahmer's point of view. It's called the Jeffrey Dahmer story, but it's not just about him and his backstory. It's the repercussions. It's how society and our system failed to stop him multiple times because of racism and homophobia. It's a tragic story." End quote. Now, we as a podcast have always been cognizant of the fact that we are not telling stories, but instead are talking about real human beings' lives and the tragic and unnecessary end of those lives in some circumstances. The fact is that Dahmer is a part of American history, an ugly part of it, to be sure, much like much of our history as a country, and these stories will always be told and retold. The push, however, is to hold the creators of all the mediums that cover these stories accountable to a certain level of ethics and responsibility with respect to the victims and their families. This is an incredibly important shift that needs to occur within all forms of the medium that cover true crime, because it's the right thing to do. So, taking into consideration what Evan Peters says Ryan Murphy's mandate was regarding the point of view of the series being from the victims as opposed to Dahmer, the question is, did they achieve what they sought to achieve? The answer to that is yes and no. Which, yes, I realize is basically not an answer, but it's true. Because it did and it didn't. But before we get into the nuts and bolts, the first thing that I have to mention is that Evan Peters' portrayal of one of the foulest humans to ever walk the earth was outstanding. I will not be surprised if he wins the Emmy for the performance. Now, I have no idea what his acting technique is, but if he is a method actor, which means to a certain extent that you stay in character as much as possible, sometimes even when you're not performing, well, then his transformation into the ugliness and evil that was Dahmer was so convincing that I feel like that he may have to undergo intense psychotherapy in order to shake Dahmer's persona from his psyche. During the series, I often found myself forgetting that it wasn't actually Dahmer on screen. His performance was just that good. The series starts, as promised, from the point of view of Dahmer's last victim, a man named Tracy Edwards. Edwards had been lured back to Dahmer's evil lair under the pretense that Dahmer was going to pay Edwards to allow him to take some photographs of him. The entirety of the first episode follows Edwards' pulse-pounding, terrifying encounter with Dahmer, which he incredibly survived, as he narrowly escaped and then led the cops back to his apartment, which, mercifully, put an end to Dahmer's reign of terror. So the first episode was very compelling and was extremely effective in allowing the viewer to share in the terror that Edwards was feeling throughout the harrowing narrow escape. But as exhilarated as I was with Tracy Edwards' heroic actions, not only to escape but to force the cops back to Dahmer's place, where they unbelievably finally arrested him, was equal to how disappointed I was in the second episode, which brought us back to Dahmer's youth. Now look, I realize that there are those of you out there that crave that information, but it's a story that's been told ad nauseum, and I personally just had zero interest in it. And honestly, having just completed what Darren and I believe to be without question the most authoritative series ever done on Gacy in any format, feel that we are in an unusual position to be able to comment on this aspect of the series. If you've listened to season one of DD, then you know that we avoided talking about Gacy and his past as much as possible, as we chose to focus on the victims and giving them a name, the investigation and the arrest and the trial. And we did this because we had no interest in retelling you what you can easily watch or read in at least 30 other books, docs, or movies that have been made about the creep. So I'm guessing that the writers, Murphy and Brennan, and the network felt that it was necessary to give some background on Dahmer for those who were tuning in who were either oblivious when the story broke or were too young to be aware of it. So I get why they did it. However, it did nothing for me. And sadly, Dahmer's backstory would eat up the next three episodes as they followed Dahmer through his early years, his teenage years, through his enlistment in the army, and the period of time that he lived with his poor grandmother. These episodes follow his devolution from awkward and lonely youth into murdering psychopath, and in episode 5, the writers begin zeroing in on the utter incompetence of the Milwaukee police. Now, I consider there to be 3 main characters in the series: Dahmer, his father Lionel, and Dahmer's neighbor Brenda Cleveland. As large chunks of the series focus on these central characters and covers the frustrations and terror that Lionel and Brenda experienced before, during, and after Dahmer was finally exposed. Now, one thing to keep in mind in seeing that it was such a major plot point, which was used to hammer home the fact that the Milwaukee PD were inept, was that Glenda shared a common wall with Dahmer in the building. It is common in scripted serialized shows like this that creative liberties are taken, and Dahmer was no exception. As I was so appalled by what the series was representing with respect to portraying Glenda smelling dead bodies, hearing power tools being used and young men screaming in agony through the cold air return in her apartment, that I had to Google whether or not this was true, because I simply can't imagine a world where this was actually taking place and that Glenda's pleas to the police were continually being ignored. What a quick Google search revealed was that this massively important plot arc was not a complete work of fiction, but that Glenda was an amalgam of a couple of Dahmer's neighbors, namely Glenda Cleveland and a woman named Pamela Bass. Now, Glenda was a neighbor of Dahmer's, but she did not live in the same building, let alone share a wall with him. No, she lived in the building across the street. Pamela Bass at least lived in the building and claimed to have smelled dead bodies when Dahmer was active. Now, I probably shouldn't have Googled it, because finding that out midway through, frankly, really pissed me off, as in my opinion, it was just too much creative liberty that was being taken. I mean, the story is horrific enough. Why did they feel the need to sensationalize it in order to invoke outrage with respect to the Milwaukee Police Department's incompetence? Especially in light of the fact that the story of the 14-year-old Laotian boy, Konarak, was absolutely true. And it was in fact Glenda and her daughter that contacted the police as the incoherent, drugged boy wandered aimlessly outside of Dahmer's apartment. And it was eerily similar to the Gacy story when Dahmer simply told the cops that Konarak was his drunk 19-year-old boyfriend and that all was well. It was identical to the way that Gacy relied on the cops' indifference with respect to gay men and their domestic tiffs. Point being is that story alone, without fabricating this continuous story arc of Brenda staring at the vent as the horrors of Dahmer's apartment consistently snaked their way into hers, was more than enough to invoke the requisite outrage that the writers were seeking. I just didn't get it. So as I huffed and puffed my way into episode 6, all of the writer's sins and transgressions were soon forgiven, as that particular episode was an absolute masterpiece. This episode was a masterclass on how to put together a victim-focused story, as it centered around Tony Hughes being a living, breathing human being. 90% of that episode was filmed from Tony Hughes' point of view. And in order to immerse the viewer deeper into who Tony Hughes was, a majority of the episode contains absolutely no dialogue, as that was Tony's reality, as he was hearing impaired, having lost his hearing as an infant. I was mesmerized and had high hopes that the series had turned the corner. It was going to deliver on its promise to be more victim-focused, because in watching that particular episode, it becomes clear that stories of serial killers do not have to focus on the killer in order to be compelling, as it so effectively drives home how humanizing the victims is the more humane and effective way to reach the viewers. Much to my chagrin, it never got as good as that again, as the series shifted back to Glenda and Jesse Jackson attempting to use the tragedies to shine light on the racism that existed within the underserved Black communities in Milwaukee. While everything it was portraying was absolutely true, it simply felt like a throw-in episode to me, as it lacked the heart of episode 6. Episode 7, well, it had me intrigued initially, as it focused on Dahmer's father, Lionel, and his struggles with coming to grips with who and what his son was, and what hand he may have had in making him into the monster that he became. I was particularly interested because if you've listened to season 2 of Defense Diaries, you know that we count the parents of these awful human beings as victims as well. In a much different way, in a much different sense than the victims whose lives were stolen and the families that were left behind. But they are victims nonetheless. I came away feeling that the composition of this episode was muddled, as Richard Jenkins, who's an excellent actor, was tasked with the challenge of creating empathy for his character while also leaving wiggle room for assigning some blame to him for what his son turned out to be. It had the bones to be a deeply moving and poignant episode, but it missed the mark, in my opinion. I think that both Murphy and Brennan were waffling on how to portray Lionel, and that came through in the end product. And what irritated me even more is that either the writers or the network or both decided to completely skip the trial, aside from a couple of the victim impact statements that were given post-conviction. These just rang hollow to me, as if they were a grifter's ruse to arouse empathy from the viewer. Yes, the actress who played Rita Isbell did a fine job in recreating the absolutely gut-wrenching victim impact statement she gave in court in 1992. But the choice to stick them in the show without even having acknowledged that the trial had taken place stripped the statements of the power that they possess and what purpose they serve in a trial. That episode just stunk of straight exploitation to me. Episode 9 shifts between Glenda and the victims' families dealing with the aftermath of the horrors that Dahmer created. Lionel publishing a book, which of course was viewed by the public and the victims' families as a shameless, soulless money grab, which of course it was. And Dahmer basking in the glory of his infamy as he sorts through his twisted fan mail. Finally, we get to episode 10. And to my utter shock, the episode opens in Chicago, Illinois, with a PDM van pulling into a driveway. I immediately recognize that Murphy and Brennan have attempted to figure out a way to incorporate Gacy into the story. Double the bang for your serial killer buck, I guess. In the brief 4-minute opening scene, which depicts Gacy luring in and murdering one of his victims, I was left stunned at how factually inaccurate that scene was at every turn. Not only was it inaccurate, it was the most gratuitous, shock value bit of schlock that I had seen in a long time. They had Gacy drowning his helpless victim in a bathtub while decked out in full pogo makeup and attire. It was an assault on my senses and sensibility. And talk about a cheap carny trick, that scene was an abomination in so many ways that it's hard to count. Now, throughout the rest of the episode, they sprinkle in bits of Gacy throughout, as Dahmer catches the 94 interview of the creep being conducted mere months before his execution. This interview apparently spurred Dahmer to get right with the Lord, and he decides to get baptized. All the while, fellow inmate Christopher Scarver, who battles mental illness himself, continues to simmer in his cell as he obsesses about killing Dahmer, as he has convinced himself that he is a vessel sent by God to execute God's vengeance, which he does. In what was by far the most graphic depiction of violence in the entire series, as he proceeds to cave Dahmer's head in by repeatedly crushing his skull with a dumbbell bar in the prison's mysteriously empty gym. The series ends with a legal battle between Dahmer's parents over the end destination of the cannibal killer's brain, which the judge ultimately decides needs to be torched. And then, in a sad final attempt to show the victims just how much they care, they focused on Glenda Cleveland continuing her fight to have the empty lot where Dahmer's building once stood to be turned into a park memorializing the victims. Now, I have to believe that Murphy and Brennan went to war with the suits at Netflix about the inclusion of many of these scenes, because there were just too many flashes of greatness within the series to lead me to believe that the end product was their actual vision for the picture. But maybe I'm wrong. In the final analysis, if you were looking for all of the grisly details of the murders of Dahmer's 17 victims, the series was not the series for you. because those scenes are thankfully avoided like the plague. As the only true bit of graphic violence was reserved for Dahmer getting his just desserts from Scarver, as I imagine the showrunners believed that the viewers would find that to be a fulfilling end to a real piece of shit's life. And maybe you did feel that way. For me, it came off as calculated and formulaic. And if you were going into this with trepidation, with the hopes that the promise of a victim-centric telling of the story was before you, you too will soon find out that your reservations about the series and how it would handle the delicate issue of memorializing the victims as opposed to exploiting them were well placed. Because for all its efforts to do this, it is ultimately just another series focused on Dahmer, that at certain points actually attempts to invoke sympathy for the soulless killer, while peppering the series with small glimpses into the victims and their lives. If only the showrunners had followed the formula of episode 6 throughout, this would have been a true turning point in the industry on how these stories are told from the perspective of the victim. Alas, it was not to be. As the piece, despite its touts to the contrary, ended up being nothing more than victim exploitation, even if not done so intentionally. So, at the end of the day, I give the Dahmer Limited series 3 gavels. And one entire gavel is due exclusively to the performance of Evan Peters. So, do with that what you will. Talk to you next time.